much different, and it's very, very full of different concepts, different ideas, different approaches, different views of how it should be done or should it be done at all. So if, our plan is to give a little bit of introduction, to show one way of how it came into science or how it started tackling the scientific cognitive science water, and then we will present how we got together, just a little bit of first-person testimony, and then we would like to open the discussion, which will be based on some questions that we think are relevant and will be presented later. But before we do that, I would be really happy if we can get some feedback of you, because as I said, it is so much new and there are so many different ideas connected to first-person research. Please, that there are two more chairs here. So perhaps if anybody feels like sharing what actually brought you here, what's your background, what do you think first person research is, this kind of stuff, I would be really happy. We would really have to break the ice, please.
I'm a philosopher and I've been defending the view that there's a unique kind of phenomenology to conscious thought, so phenomenology or cognition. And one objection that I get frequently is, I don't detect any such phenomenology. In my own case, friends will say, well, I think I just hear words or I see images, and I don't detect this kind of phenomenology at all. So the reason I'm here is that I think when it comes down to, well, I expect my experience on this, and someone else says, well, I expect my experience on this. Okay, now what? Yes, you do, just don't want to say, well, how do we know what we want to do on this? So I've actually given that kind of objection, I think, virtually presented the transcendental argument that there must be such anomalies, so it's just a little harder. But I'm very interested in third-person approaches to evaluating people's claims about the objective and about their experience. So, and in particular, this kind of anomaly that exists.
Thank you very much. So, can I just would you take that the rephrasement of your question, if I say, is intersubjectivity? Is it what you're talking something about connected to intersubjectivity? Or the question, can this kind of stuff from another research or first person be intersubjectively validated? Is that it? Or did I miss?
Yeah, well, yes.
That is one of our central questions. So, yeah, please.
Of course, even intersubjectivity, I mean, just going back, I know it sounds repetitive, implies that there is a shared experience going on. I mean, the old example of the colorblind person from birth doesn't have the experience to see the color blue, and language and third person analysis or whatever won't help there. So, in a sense, what brought me was toward a science of consciousness that seemed like an oxymoron, because if you mean by consciousness the first person point of view experience of seeing the world, how can there be a science that implies a detachment? Because the third person will have to look from his first person point of view in order to do that. So you can't get away from your own consciousness. So, well, that's why I'm at this conference, at this meeting, because hopefully you'll tell us how it's done.
Let's give you 2 minutes to leave because the people here might tell you. But that's the second central question. Can this be signed?
Okay.
Exactly. Thank you so much. Have some more. Perhaps we said.
Yeah, let's say one more person, maybe, and then go on.
Are courageous. And there is also the third central question, but nobody mentioned this, so I'm surprised.
Can I say something? Can I maybe say something to that? And I'll start by recapitulating, because I think it was hard for the people in the front to hear. I strained. That's okay. People over here are valiantly trying to stop the air conditioner, but it's hard. You gave up. Okay. It's taken over, right? The third person is fighting back. Your point really, if I understood it, was you were surprised that we didn't start off by really emphasizing the fundamental intuition that we have, that the most important tool, in a sense, is available to us for understanding consciousness is our own subjective experience. Is that a kind of a shorthand statement? I mean, I know you said a great deal more, but that's the main point, I think.
Yes, but, all psychology and intuition might be grounded on something that's already part of the scientific literature.
Yeah, right.
And I was thinking of scholars here on epistemic properties that identify with that on first principle of art. And that was built up not the personality of the person, but for example, community parenting with the identification, the fact that if I am hungry, I cannot be wrong as the person I'm thinking about in the same way.
Right.
I think wrong when jumping in the
right. So there's.
Right.
So then, in support of what you were saying, and I'm going to just summarize again now, there is a lot of literature on a certain order of knowing that's available at the first person level, which in some ways seems to have a higher epistemic authority. Certain kinds of infallibility, although of course the infallibility issue is a hotly debated one in philosophy. So in terms of summary, I think maybe that's enough for now. And my only response to that is I'm really assuming that the people who are in this room come out of that intuition, out of that sense that there is something very wrong if you try to establish a science of consciousness that does not take into account what seems to be the fundamental experience of consciousness, which Thomas Nagel famously identified, and I believe the term was used by someone else before, as the what it's like experience, that there is a what it's like to conscious experience, and that's why we've really entitled this workshop What It's Like, because that gets at the heart of the first person issue.
Yeah, I do believe that all these three people that broke the ice actually summarized the very idea but pretty well. Mm-hmm. And this dichotomy between what you said, so that this is quite existentially natural and it's somehow really natural to take this into account, first person account into account when studying consciousness, and on the other side the question of intersubjectivity and the question whether that can be scientific, that whether that can be done in this scientific milieu, can we share some of this, can we somehow validate or even have some intersubjective notion of truth. This is actually what bothers us, and actually we want to get some answers from this debate. So we had no idea how it's going to look like, what kind of ideas we'll present here. That's why we made sort of plan B, which consisted of Matej lead us briefly through the, let's say, history of how first-person methodologies came into attention in this area of cognitive science. I think perhaps we should still go through this,
yes,
but really briefly, and then we go on with the dialogue and discussion, hopefully.
I will try to present make a very short overview of what the idea of first-person research and cognitive science came to be. But I'm not trying to be comprehensive in any way. My construction is what I've read and what I've learned. I think that it's quite a good idea to start with this notion of hard problems. So this idea of this notion of hard problems is relatively recent. Say Chalmers, I think it's the 90s, 95, 94. And basically the problem of how subjectivity and objectivity are related. I mean, how does subjectivity arise from objectivity? How do the brain, we have some brain that we know somehow how they work, but we don't know how does this subjective quality of experience spring from this objective state. And of course, although this information is very recent, hard problem is not so recent. We should, it's really nothing new. It's really the same thing that Descartes, he was the first modern philosopher to support this question of the mind-body relationship. He made a split of two ontological domains. So thinking thing and business subjectivity, and really science, subsequent development of science really forgot about this and focused only on this and got marvelous results. But now, as we are trying to understand ourselves from this perspective, we are coming again to here. So it's like the question of subjectivity really pops up again. And it's a general feeling that something really important is missing, could be missing, if we are not able to include subjectivity, the quality of such a subjective experience, into our objective view on how the way forward. So,
can I just say something at that point?
One
of the interesting things is, why did this happen at this moment in time? Why are we suddenly discussing the issue of subjectivity and the heart problem and so forth? And that's a complicated question, but I just want to make two points. One is, from the point of view of a materialist science, I think what happened in the 1990s roughly was there was this really great leap in the technology that was available for studying the brain as a living phenomenon, as basically fMRI and various other things. I'm not a scientist, but especially I think of the fMRI, so that you could really see the brain in operation. And for a long time, I think scientists just said, well, the mind, consciousness, that's not a proper subject for science, and probably it doesn't even exist. We just have this illusion that it exists. But in any case, we have to ignore it because there's nothing that science can say about it. And now, suddenly, scientists were saying, there is something we can say about it. Now we're finally in a position where we can take subjective experience and study it from a third-person point of view. So partly it was an advance in third-person science that brought this issue to the fore. But at the same time, I think there's been a kind of a development in the zeitgeist, in the Weltanschauung, the way that people, what people are interested in our culture, which makes the issue of subjectivity come to the fore in a way that was perhaps not as true. Subjectivity has always been with us and always will, but there is something about the experience of that. There's a kind of a great interest and sophistication about it that you see in our popular culture. And I think that also plays into it. So you actually get both themes, both streams coming together in the emergence of this question at this time.
That is a larger cultural context that I wasn't going to go into that. Where was I?
Before Matej finds where he was, I would just like to point out that we are doing this all the time. We have that, and please join us. There is no real logical step from brain processing to quality of experience. There simply isn't. So that's the real problem. And
what about affect and physiology and emotion? Sorry? Your affect, physiology, emotion, kind of things. You know, like polyglotting cases all around the world, different cultures. What they have when they experience different emotions, you know, they all have the same facial expressions.
So yes, there is this idea in philosophy, idea of zombies,
to understand zombies. But what I was talking about is the subjective, the relationship between the subjective and objective that you're talking about. You know, tying in with physiology.
But the question is not the relation, but why one comes from the top, one comes from the other.
Maybe you could put it that way,
The correlation is not the question. Was your question about correlation?
Well, the question mark in between, you know, right now we're trying to study, you know, the neural correlation to you know, subjective experience, et cetera. You know, that's where
there was no correlation.
But then, you know, if you look at kind of, you know, the way that we breathe, you know, whether we're angry or, and you know, mirror neurons, you know, all this kind of stuff, you know, empathy and a lot of these kind of things, there seems to be some kind of common universality in terms of the human experience.
That's true, but I mean, the idea of zombies is someone who reacts exactly like I do and doesn't experience anything. So I cannot tell if you're not zombies, you cannot tell if I'm not zombies. Okay, so that's the question. Okay, I have this specific feeling that I'm not a zombie and you're not a zombie. So that's basically why I talk to you. But the question is how the system speaks from. Or maybe vice versa, I don't know, it's really not possible. So, some people, this is really, really hard. I think that the whole problem is, the whole thing is, in a way, the problem is put, it wasn't put quite from the beginning. But now some people are really trying to take a pragmatic view on this, in this relationship. So they say, okay, we cannot, so another time. Another term I thought is experimental gap. So some people are asking this question, okay, we cannot really close the gap. But maybe we could try to bridge it. Across this divide, and one recent proposal, very recent proposal, and I think it is the most developed front of this proposal is European terminology. So basic idea is. Let's work simultaneously on both sides. We try to observe things from the first person perspective and from the third person perspective. And then let's see if there are some mutual constraints in these two spines from these two elements. And in this way, these mutual constraints for Breva represent a bridge that can expand the divide of the institution. But then another question arises, or another problem arises, and has to do with the fact that the methodology on the third person side is so very much better developed than the methodology on the first person side. So this is basically the idea, okay, we should start developing the methodology on the first, so first person, and we should start. This is very, very well developed, and this is very poorly developed. So we cannot make this correlation because this is Middle Ages science, and this is advanced modern science. So the idea is to try to develop the methodology on the first person side. Of course, people are beginning to realize that there have been a lot of work done in this first person side, but not in science. So there are three major sources of influence when people start to develop this first person methodology. First is introspection. I mean, I mentioned it first because it's this influential. Introspection was developed in early psychology and it's really died very shortly after conception of psychology. Then there is terminology. Terminology is, of course, a topic of philosophy, and mostly the authors draw from Husserl. not really highly another so technology and the other probably the most important, not the most important, but probably this technology and the third influence is Buddhism. Or in general, this process in general, but Buddhism most important. So this is a kind of a map of what is happening now. People trying to develop first person methods, drawing from experience or drawing from knowledge from these three sources. And that would be the end of my short
yeah. I don't understand why you distinguish people special from the other two. What do you mean by introspection?
It's historical. I mean, introspection.
Okay, so
it's introspection is movement in Germany, I think.
Introspection is in the beginning of psychology. This is Wundt, Technology is developed in another area and has another ontological commitment, basically, to look at it from introspection. And Buddhism has another ethical commitment.
According to Catherine Kuhn, I think I pronounced the name correctly, from the talk, I know she gave a talk last year at Consciousness Studies Seminar. She believed that there was an unbridgeable gap as far as Buddhism was concerned, that we hadn't overcome the dualism problem. Buddhism implies a dualistic approach. But anyway, the other question I mentioned was that even though the third person's approach has been tremendously developed, it doesn't seem to have gotten anywhere in terms of solving, you know, what this felt experience is. I mean, it's worked on the correlation and aspect, but I just wondered if you agree with McKinn's thesis that basically we just don't have the cognitive ability to bridge this gap. Colin again.
Yeah.
I don't really think it's a matter of cognitive ability. I think it's a matter of how the problem is posed. And the whole third person science is a consequence of this thing. So we are actually, when we're thinking about the heart problem, we are not, I mean, we're trying to solve the heart problem scientifically. I think this is possible because our problem is outside science. It's in small science. Some things when you think of our problem, you're going to get out of science. But this is something that we should be discussing.
I want to say something about representation. I think one of the challenges of bridging the gap is finding a method of representing first person data, which can in some way map onto kind of representation and how it's objectively from inside. Within the scientific third person world, explanations often happen by finding two representations, two things that seem different, and then over a period of time morphing the representations into a series of laws and think two things are actually one and the same thing. So one of the things that I find interesting about Buddhism is that they actually have a description of the meditative experience which actually has a representation which sounds scientific, which is that I am in one point, you know, as I meditate, the third I participate, you know, into the cosmos, which is kind of something we call this world or draw something that might have something representative match as some objective. I'm kind of interested to know, is there any work being done now to actually find any kind of graphical or mathematical or anything that has representations of first person people?
I'm aware, just very casually at this point, of someone who probably is going to be trying to put a map on that particular issue because she's looking at the, from what a Buddhist perspective you'd call the ground of consciousness, and how conscious experience emerges out of the ground of consciousness, although I don't think she's going to use a Buddhist vocabulary. You know, there are a lot of people trying a lot of different things. Just looking through the program for the conference here, there are a number of papers, and I've always found this at the Tucson conferences also, people who think they have a particular take on how you could study first-person consciousness. And one of the issues that we're concerned with, or how you could develop a first-person methodology, one of the issues that we think is really tremendously important is you know, do you just wind up with a whole bunch of different people trying a whole bunch of different things, or could you, allowing a tremendous amount of openness in the beginning, but could you begin to move toward some kind of consensus, or at least a variety of different schools? I think it's probably fair to say that we share the sense that while first-person methodologies is absolutely essential for an understanding of consciousness, it really is in a very significant way in its infancy. In the West, Buddhism, which happens to be my background, and we can say something about background in a moment, but it's not in its infancy in Buddhism, absolutely. But whether a Buddhist approach to the understanding of consciousness, which, as Matei was saying, brings in an entire ethical dimension, whether that can be applied within a scientific framework, I think that's a very open question as well. So wherever you look, whatever point you touch, a new, a stream of questions, a fountain of questions bubbles up. And that seems, in the first place, very exciting, and in the second place, appropriate for something that science has made so much of a taboo, as Alan Wallace calls it, for so many years. Now that we're sort of peering behind that screen, all sorts of things, there are all sorts of little creepy crawlies. Yeah.
But, I mean, you mentioned Buddhism, but, if you look at, what we're trying to talk about here, too, is just how do you communicate inner experience,
right?
And what is the language, and how to do that. So Buddhism is one, but nearly all religions, around the world have their own language. And, the issue is that if you have that belief system, look at Joseph Campbell, etc.
Mm-hmm.
If you have that belief system, then you can communicate fairly well your first-person experiences with other people.
Right.
The challenge is how you build a kind of a universal platform that can touch on common experiences across different cultures.
Right. I think that one of the reasons that Buddhism attracts a lot of interest, and I'm not sure about this, but is that it seems to have a really well-developed methodology. It's not just a question of having a way of describing the experience, but it says, if you want to investigate this kind of experience, here is what you need to do. And it's exactly in that domain of methodology. Because people can, of course, describe religious experiences in an infinite variety of ways. But if you say, here's a methodology for going into that, then Buddhism seems to offer something very rich. Other traditions, I'm sure, do too. But so far, if we kind of judge by the marketplace of ideas, when you go to these conferences, it's mostly Buddhism you hear talked about. Not only, but mostly.
But isn't going into these elaborate intellectual systems, I mean, is that really the way to go? Because, on the other hand, Buddhism talks about the koan, the focus on totally non-logical, non-propositional sentence, and get beyond language, get beyond our cognitive and analytical drive to make sense of something. And then the Zen experience doesn't seem to me to be an approach based on elaborate intellectual systems. There you're supposed to totally wash out distracting thoughts, and it seems to me very visceral and very non-intellectual. How do you reconcile it?
Well, one of the difficulties in talking about Buddhism is that it's at least as vast a field of inquiry as whatever Western civilization has produced. It's got 2,500 years of history across dozens of cultures. And the Zen tradition, my own background is in Tibetan Buddhism, I'm not going to say anything about Tibetan Buddhism, because that would take us way too far afield. But in that tradition, there is a very systematic analysis growing out of Indian Buddhism, which is quite different from the Zen approach. And not that they lead to a different point, but they do take a different approach. And there, this kind of analysis and careful inquiry into the nature of how the mind operates is a very important element in what you do. It's not the only element, but it's there and it's been carefully explored. So maybe we could say a little bit now about how we kind of came to this, because I think it will help frame our perspective, and then that will lead into the question of, well, at that point we will lay out some questions that we think could help clarify this field, and then throw it open for discussion, really, hopefully within the framework of those questions.
Yeah, I think those questions were laid out already.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's just, like, for example, your last question, which is about Zen, not so much about Buddhism, but it's just a question, actually, can this be, is there any sense of this intellectual mumbo-jumbo, or should we just go directly to experience, which is like, and also my answer to your question would be that Zen, for example, which I know a little bit of, is exactly, it has no dogmatic, almost no dogmatic surroundings. It's just experience. Even Suzuki, as I just read it, he said if you expect enlightenment, you're on the wrong path, just observe whatever there is. Which is very scientific attitude, I guess. But yeah, so just that's my first thought on that. But we somehow decided that we would just a brief 1 minute introduction of where we are, how we came to this, because that's sort probably a way to do it to start a first person debate. It's really dangerous if we just go and speak about something, for example, philosophical view of this, or neuroscientific or Buddhist view, and we think everybody understands where we stand, and just they have to communicate with us. And our paths are pretty much different, so perhaps that can be a start, and then we go on with those questions that we just started with. Perhaps, Matej, you were challenged before.
Your opinion on this? Okay. My background in PC is psychology, and my interest in first person inquiries mainly comes from a certain point from that psychology is so very afraid of not being assigned. And in order to be assigned, he tries to really be rigorous methodology and tries to be very rigorous, but in order to do this, you have to omit all the important directions. I mean, you have to focus on really small issues, some really issues that you can put in experiment and so on. So you really leave aside all the important issues. And so if I wanted to tackle get more important issues, that's, of course, where the motivating force that brought me to psychology. Then I eventually had to turn to first-person inquiry, really first-person, and then I thought that it was a and then I tried to build that kind of deal. So, this is short of the
yeah, my story is actually, I did traverse longer path. I'm physicist, mathematical physicist by my original background, theoretical physicist, and I was doing Feynman diagrams and then found out about neural networks, which were still in the physical context, spin glasses, and then I totally switched. Actually, I was studying philosophy parallelly. And so then my first part of my career was modeling cognition with artificial neural networks. And I got in contact with Varela stuff. I wanted to do an autopoietic system with neural networks, and I was really frustrated all the time. So I said, well, we have to figure out methodology. We cannot just do this third person, I didn't call it third person at that time, methodology, because to answer one mission, or even bigger, which should be answered first, actually, is life. It's not possible by artificially generated system. So, meaning it's not possible algorithmically, and then somehow I got into contact with this constructivist movement. I met von Foerster and von Glasersfeld, and all this combination, and Václavík, the the past I was sort of this privilege to have some lessons with him, and so somehow, but especially von Förster led me to this idea that artistic story position is how it should be done when we are talking and studying consciousness. So that's actually my part, and then I'm doing this first person research in a way which is really, we couldn't go further from the theoretical physics, or perhaps not, because actually theoretical physics was the first to notice that observer is actually sort of participating in this. So perhaps it's just fate. Actually, to me, it seems that it's just one thing all the time. But yeah, now I'm pretty much into this dialogical stuff, and I'm also a methodologist. I want to see your question actually, is there a way to do science which is not where intersubjective confirmation or validation is not the main parameter for building community, for seeking the truth? That's actually my big question. Also, the other question is, I'm more and more recognizing that this first-person research is not about what to find, but it's about the process. That this, the dialogical process that goes on is actually the point of first-person research. But I don't dare to talk about that because it's so strange and not scientific, because there's actually nothing to hold on. So that's fine.
And my background, hopefully briefly, is very different from all of that. I really have no scientific background at all. My academic training was as a lawyer, and I practiced law for a little while. And I must say I was glad when I got into this field to see that Thomas Nagel, who's one of the respected figures, is also a lawyer, so I thought, well, okay. And then I got very involved in Buddhism. And for the last 27 years, I've been a full-time member of a Buddhist community founded by a Tibetan Lama in California. And I have certain reservations as a result of that work that I've done. Buddhism is, you know, I have no reservations about Buddhism and about the value of what it offers. But I think that if you're going to be a Buddhist, then you're a Buddhist. Whether you can take the Buddhist perspective and pull out certain pieces of it and say, well, this is going to be helpful for science, I have my doubts about that. And more generally, I have some doubts about the whole program of making the Buddhist teachings and traditions available in the West. I think there's a place for that, but there are also real problems, and I think that one needs to, if one is interested in the kinds of things that Buddhism is interested in, which has to do with ending suffering and liberation of human beings, you need to also explore other approaches that work better for the Western mind. So, or maybe not better, but at least offer another alternative for the Western mind. And so I started looking around and exploring that, and one of the areas where I feel, you know, that has been the most fruitful for me has been this area of consciousness studies. So I think in 1998 I went to my first Tucson conference, and I got all the back issues of Journal of Consciousness Studies. I have to give a wave to Anthony back there. I think they do a really important job in laying this field out. And in going through those issues, I saw, you know, yes, there is a place for the kinds of things that I'm interested in. So I started doing a little writing. Matei and Raban and I met through their contacting me as a result of an article that I've done in JCS. At the same time, in 2006, just last year, I organized the conference through the Center for Creative Inquiry, which is the organization I founded to look into these things. That was held at a Buddhist retreat center, but in no way was Buddhist. It's the Ratnaling Retreat Center, so we call it the Ratnaling Conference. And invited a number of people who were interested in first-person inquiry. And we had, I think, 14 people there at that first meeting, and it seemed very fruitful. We held a second meeting this past March, also at Ratnaling, and Urban and Mate attended this one. And I think it began to focus in more on the question of what are some specific methodologies? How do you actually go about doing this? Because you can theorize about it a lot. But you know, so what do you do? And right now I think some of the most interesting work is being done really in the field of second person inquiry. How do you work with someone else to allow that person to be able to go more deeply into their own experience? Okay, I think that's going to be enough. Let's stop there and just go on. Yes, we'll stop there and go on. So what I want to do is, let's see if it just works by itself. Yes? So this is the way we have laid out some of the questions we thought would be interesting to explore. And as Urban said, these have really all been just about all touched on already in the questions that have come up as we've proceeded, but why don't we just go through them very quickly and then maybe come back and see what people have to say about them. So the first is the issue of intersubjective validation, repeatability, and I think the point that was made of incommensurability, you could say. If I have one kind of experience and someone else says, no, I don't have that kind of experience, what do you do? That was the rock on which the ship of introspection foundered. So that's a significant problem. And then the issue of experimental method. Does it make sense even to think about experimental method as something that applies in the field of first person inquiry? And more generally, the issue of methodology, the question that's come up of should we be aiming towards a single methodology, or should we say no, there can be multiple methodologies, or should we perhaps say, as comes up in the Zen context, no methodology at all? The very moment that you try to take your experience and turn it into something that is the subject of a method, you have so fundamentally altered it that you lose the ability to understand the experience. That's certainly also a valid position one could take. And then the issue of dialogue versus reporting. There are a lot of ways to put that dichotomy, the past versus the present. Science is always reporting on its results, which means it's always past-centered. But experience takes place in the present. So how do you reconcile those two things? Science also, of course, is always looking for explanation and prediction, which again take you into the past and the future. But if you're in the present, how do you communicate that? Okay, then there's the issue of existential involvement. The scientific model, third-person model, is essentially one of distanced observation. You exclude the observer, and that's absolutely critical to the scientific method. Granted that, you know, that the particle physics calls that into question in certain ways, certain aspects or certain interpretations, but in general, you exclude the role of the observer. So if there's that fundamental difference, then what is the range of possibilities? One possibility is that you'd say, first, there should be a first-person science, and it should just be proceed in parallel, in effect. It does not have anything to do with third-person science. Another possibility is that it should be complementary. That's the neurophenomenology approach. And Varela talks in terms of mutual constraints. First-person experience and third-person data should set mutual constraints on one another. So that's another possibility. Another possibility is to say this has nothing to do with science. And there are people who are very respected in the field who are essentially behaviorists. I don't know if they would accept that label, but who are also meditators. And they will say, yes, I go home in the evening and meditate, but that's not what science is about, and those two things should be completely separate. So that's another possibility. And then there's the issue of practical professional significance, which, because I'm not in the field of science, is not so immediately meaningful to me, but it comes up whenever I talk with people who are. They basically say, if we're teaching in the field of science, we cannot train our students to do first-person science because they can't get jobs. So if we do it at all, we have to do it around the edges. So that's what's involved in that question of practical significance. And then finally, the question is, what kind of knowledge do you generate? Mary, the color challenged scientist, is helps bring that issue into the fore. But the basic idea is knowledge propositional, or are there kinds of knowledge which have nothing to do with propositions? It would seem that first person knowledge of one's own consciousness is not propositional. That the whole propositional model involves a third person attitude towards what's known. So that raises the question of, is there something like that that really counts as knowledge? But there are other issues there, and some of them have to do with the motivations for research. Science has its motivation, which has to do with explanation, prediction, and control. Whereas philosophy has a more, how shall we say it quickly, is interested in understanding, and therefore, in a sense, is not plagued by the same kinds of difficulties that science has in bringing these things into its model, because philosophy can always ask another question. Psychotherapy has a very different motivation, which is to help people, and the spiritual path, although it's also about helping people, is yet again a different motivation because it has to do with developing consciousness toward a higher stage or a higher level, which may or may not be an issue in psychotherapy, depending on the kind of psychotherapy. And then there are ethical issues, and what we mean there is not necessarily issues about what are the right things to do, but more this question of enacted understanding. If your concern is first personal, then and you are not going to accept experimental results, for instance, as the test or the measure for what counts, maybe what counts is how do you enact the results of your understanding of consciousness. And maybe that's a possibility. Maybe the ethical stance that you take is the validator for your experience. That's at least one range of possibilities. So that's a lot to throw out there. I can see people kind of trying to take it in. But why don't we go back up, and I don't think we need to go in exact order here. We have about half an hour, and then we'll want to sum up. So we have about half an hour to explore some of these issues. So perhaps we could at least divide it into these three areas and turn first to the issue of intersubjective validation and some of the sub-issues and see what people have to say. Yeah.
On the topic of knowledge of pragmatics, perhaps. My own experience is that, my background is in popular science, but when I talk to philosophers and say, so what about phenomenology? Let's get together and just try out what is phenomenological deduction, let's say, and describe something and see if we can match it up. Usually they laugh and say, what? You actually want to do this? And it's usually textual study of the other set that
comes
from. So maybe also something jumping ahead a little bit, but you're saying, for example, something about an internet forum that might be set up and so on. So my suggestion would be to find an example in literature that's quite well described by someone important, say, Husserl, and then say, look, this is an object. Everybody go home, do your homework, try to describe your experience, go post it all on the forum and see, well, how much invariance can you actually discover in our experiences? And if you don't, then why not? And if you come to an agreement, actually do it and see what happens.
Right, and in that way you would be raising one of the questions, which is, is invariance really what we want to be looking for? That's what Husserl was looking for, but in fact, does it turn out that that's the most fruitful approach to this kind of inquiry? But asking that kind of question would be roughly speaking, at least an experimental method, and I think, yes, in a forum, or if you had a community. And one of the words I think Orban mentioned, or Mate, we haven't really touched on it, is it does seem, I think all three of us shared this idea, that ultimately if we want to make progress in this field, there's going to have to be a community of inquiry. And that really is true in any kind of science or any kind of inquiry, really. But what that means, especially if you don't share certain methodological presuppositions, how that will play itself out, that's a big question. But that would be one of the kinds of things you could explore in a community like that. Yes.
Can I add something to that?
Yeah.
Just briefly. It's connected. My comment is connected to this second question. It's essentially important. So if I take a cube and then try to
describe how I experience it. This is probably not really existentially important for me. But and so I can seek for intersubjective validation. Do you experience the cube in the same way? But if I'm tackling some existentially important issue for me, okay, that's should I take this career or that career or something like that? I mean, this is I'm the only person in this situation, so there can be no real intersubjective validation. This is kind of these three questions are kind of interrelated.
There were two.
Okay, yeah, you're right. There were other people. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, okay. It just seems to me like there's a lot of confusion when we're just talking sort of vaguely about first-person methods. Like, I know the what it's like maple paper is something very sensory, almost, talking about what it's like to be a bat. And, but a lot of the interest in this issue is, I think, what we brought up with Buddhism, which is really an issue of first-person methods with regard to religious experience. And it probably helps to make a pretty sharp disjunction between the two so that we can clarify exactly what we're talking about when we're talking about first-person methods.
Well, you know, I think actually that is very much related to what Matej was just saying, goes to this question of existential commitment. And, you know, my own sense of that, but it's just my sense, is that really consciousness has to do with the whole situation in which one finds oneself embedded, and it has to do with the values that one wishes to live one's life by, although Matej wouldn't agree with that formulation. But in any event, it has to do with what's meaningful. And I do think that one of the problems that comes up in first-person inquiry is if you confine yourself too strongly to the field of perception, and saying, you know, okay, what about this cube, as Matej said, really I think, you know, betraying the continuing power of the third-person model by restricting yourself in that way, you've created an artificial situation that may very well not make it possible for you to understand at a deep level what consciousness is all about. So I think the distinction needs to get made, but boy, a lot of people would disagree with me on that, I'm sure, and those people have their right to do their kind of inquiry too, that's my take. So who else? Yes, you go ahead.
It's a very general question, but as you said so far, the maybe a majority of neuropsychology. In fact, subject. So there is such a period on the one hand, scientific progress, which is super personal, and first-person methodology, which put rather long-term historical trends or religious traditions, etc. I would agree that on the other hand, the most perhaps research in neuropsychology to be grounded on comparison between, for example, fMRI data and objective reward. So I'm not receptive that there is such a topic
Well, there's a lot of debate on that issue, but my own sense is that a lot of people involved in third-person science would essentially make the move that Dan Dennett makes, which is to say, of course we need the reports of first-person subjective experience, but that doesn't mean we need to give any credit to those reports. We just need the reports, and we rely on the third-person experience. He calls that heterophenomenology, and there's been a big debate about whether heterophenomenology is in fact a kind of phenomenology or is just kind of a clever way of pretending that you're interested in first-person experience without really caring about it at all. It's a big issue. I think we have been making the assumption that there is really a distinction to be made here, and you're right. I mean, it is true that there are a lot of people who are trying to find ways to bring first-person phenomenology and neurophenomenology being the most well-developed example, but there are other people, Flanagan and a bunch of other people who were interested in that. Yes.
Just to add, we had this this last meeting with Rob Marie, and it was really interesting to see the whole spectrum of ideas concerning this first question. What actually the idea is what first-person research is. So perhaps on one side there is just this comparison, you know, when the neurologist asks you how do you feel this like tickling now, or he asks, well, how do you feel? Is it tickling? Now I see some white dots or something. That's on one side, and that could be taken as a sort of first-person research. And then you have the whole spectrum. Somewhere in the middle is are some researchers that were presenting in Russell Link, where people are really doing sort of phenomenological research on how people are experiencing the moment, for example, like Stern, or some particular moments, like Ross,
Robert,
and so on. And then there is another end of, or perhaps on that side, I should also include the analytical philosophers, which are known, you know, to say that, I see Apple, and that's, you know, that's all the research one has to do, and that's like a joke about the political philosophy. I'm part of it, so just, you know, a little research, but they think that's it, that's common to everybody. And on the other side, there are like people that are doing actual self-research, where a lot of variety of everything shows up, then, you know, which is, and there is a big gap actually here inside. So there is a lot of things are done named first-person research. And on that right side of the spectrum, there this question of intersubjectivization actually comes up. Because my actual experience that are really the wholeness of experience, and especially if I'm taking it very, let's say, seriously, then it's really hard to do any validation, any comparison. This wholeness, any other. That's the word.
Yeah, I think one of the issues that comes up in this is possibly many perspectives of being different ways of conceptualizing these issues. I'm right to write this paper from that really self-subjective type of research all the way to what might be this as a technological inquiry. But the portion that I'd say is that we need to be very careful on this stuff about the platform, which is like a little part of problem in explaining what that moment of consciousness is, or that subjective experience. But if we move too far into the realm of many different explanations, then we might actually know what consciousness is. We might be able to explain in any way that we can then communicate. So a hard problem of communication, I think, comes up there. Now, some of the great things I'm saying, which is about the middle way, this kind of language or experience, are right here with what ways to communicate things, but perhaps not the scale of the process.
Which connects to that last category of question: what sort of knowledge do we actually want? Is in this first person or experience research, do we really want these propositional algorithmical systems that are third person, the one of the characteristics of third person science? Or perhaps there is some other knowledge, we call it here realization or something, where you actually don't need to classify everything or have this classification, and when you don't have to transfer meaning of, you know, the content, but something else, which is to me really well described by the phrase body fly. I actually want to see body fly to be you when we do it.
Actually, related to that, I've been doing a lot of work in this area myself, using video games. So in terms of what it's like, video games are the ideal medium for kind of what it's like tech experiences, because you've got, you know, full control of, you know, visual, oral, etc. And there's causality as well too. So there's a medium for encapsulating kind of experience and inner experience. And then as people play through these things, to be able to also gather the data in terms of looking at how they respond to different things. There's a lot to
study there and medium for first person.
Well, just on that practical impression of significance, it's totally irrelevant, but you know, the moment approach to sudden revelation or insight gets to a broader question of the meaning problem in many cultures like the U.S., and I think this expresses in terms of the great problem of depression and the constant need for pills of all kinds. I mean, it might be getting too far flung off the subject, but I mean, there is something related to first person here, very intimately, that may be symptomatic of somehow a great paucity of experiential knowledge in this area of first person. You mentioned already before the need for other people to have some kind of similar base in this intersubjectivity. I mean, if they don't react in the same way, and I was just thinking of St. John of the Cross, because I'm wondering, you know, in his culture, perhaps there was more understanding intersubjective-wise, because it was pre-enlightenment and pre- empirical in many ways, is that maybe there was a much greater ease of communication of what his experiences were all about, for example, which would be impossible to intersubjective-wise.
Definitely is connected to the first person. This is, we are going to this universal field. This is still very much in back of our mind. You know, the ideal of universal field that medical science actually struggles to achieve. And here there is like the opposite, you know, totally first person. That's what the pill for me. Although, you know,
I don't know if I want to say it that way.
But there is this, so I see it as a sort of axis, a sort of continuum, which is, you know, on one side there is this attachment, and so this connected this ideal of universal field, and if this continuum is so sort of connected to this existential involvement, you know, you can be detached and observed, and then on the other side is a really importance of the issue you are researching, but then if you are, it's normally, if the issue is really important, then you want to change something. So we are at the side of psychotherapy or something, where the research part is missing, the curiosity part is missing. So I guess for it to at least have a chance to be assigned, we have to be somewhere in the middle. So of course there is always this part when you need to, you want to change, improve, whatever, but if there is this the curiosity part, the part where you're open to see what there is without trying to influence it immediately, then I guess we have no chance to really for a real inquiry. That's somehow this balance. It's really
the balance between what again?
Curiosity,
yeah.
Willing to just observe,
yeah.
But still existential importance of stuff which is normally shown as need to change something. You know, I want to change this.
Let me say one thing about that. Just, you know, Dan Dennis has written a paper many of you may be familiar with called The Fantasy of First-Person Science. And I, it's an interesting paper to look at. It's available online. It goes to the issue of methodology. And he's basically saying, you know, well, you can't trust the subject. There is no higher epistemic authority, to go back to that question. And so as a result, you're never going to have a science. Now, if you define science in a certain way, you can absolutely exclude first-person inquiry from it. There's no question about it. But if the focus of, you know, if instead you say, well, the grace of science, the what gives it its power and its beauty and its you know, you could even say spiritual significance, I think, is this commitment to a radical inquiry that sets aside bias as much as possible, that is committed to discovering the truth and thereby also the beauty of reality. First person inquiry, in my view, needs to come up with a parallel to that. Not the same thing, but something that exhibits all of those same qualities, but does it in a way that is consistent with the part of our experience that is the first person, which is in fact the heart of our experience, and the part that if you take a more narrow view of what science is, you automatically have to exclude, which is a deep, deep disappointment for people who care about what it means to be human and also find themselves involved in the scientific tradition. So that's what I think the first person approach has to offer there.
Can I use the metaphor for one second?
Yes,
sure.
Sure.
Get a deeper understanding of what you're, maybe I'm writing it down wrong.
Let's say this is everything in the world, everything, right? And say how did this, he started that. So objective world, or let's say here subjective. Subjective and objective world. So we have this seeming division, right? So this also fits perfectly for a test subject. We have a subjective experience, and with this brain here. This is what I'm into, brain imaging. And my research kind of depends also on subjective reports from the test subjects. So we have a method here, that's imaging, PET, for example. And but we also have methods here, like psychometric scores. The psychologists, they developed this in a huge science. Factor analysis of all kinds of 50 different methods. But they arrived at the tool which actually gives us an insight in what is going on in the test subject. But I agree, it's like very punctual. The tool has to be very sharp to make the comparison, for example, for correlation to the objective world. So actually, we're taking into account the subjective experience. What we do is, we do this in science, psychophysical interaction. And now this question, what you are talking about, I think this brings it, makes it clear a little bit that there is a method within this realm which where arise some insights. But also at the same time, this kind of science that I thought before, this also some kind of insight or let's say similar. And these insights here, I mean, they're real, but they're hard to communicate. And these insights are easier to communicate. I'm not going to write about them. easier to communicate. But from my personal experience, I was in Zurich when the Dalai Lama was visiting, and I'm a little bit into meditating, but not so much into any specific religion. But what thrilled me was that the insights and what they actually talked about consciousness, it was thrilling how close it was to my own kind of view to look at it. Like how we are actually taught in concepts, which is a very important part. So there, that's the interesting bridge, which I think is realistic that there might happen, that these insights, many people doing a specific thing like meditating, many people telling their experience, there might be, it might be possible, not by statistical methods, but by other methods, to find the common, like common elements of these experiences. And this speech of the Dalai Lama was astonished. I mean, it was pretty precise. And for my part, it was very close to neuroscientific insights into deep methods. So, we agree. I mean, this is the ultimate thing. While this is nice for personal development, and which is maybe the more important thing, who knows, personal development,
like religious was the sense of life.
You would get a really nice theory about this connection or whatever.
Yeah.
A really nice theory of how the inner subjective is structured or whatever. That would help anybody in really knowing him or herself.
I get nervous talking about such huge things like these are the biggest questions of the world actually, and it's not easy to not appear arrogant because there's a personal aspect. What are you? What are we? What's the sense of it all? That's one part, and I think these are also concepts which are seem to be very important to us. But since I'm working from the science part, believe it was rather not such metaphysical aspects, but also like how do concepts get life from other concepts, for example.
So we have about 5 minutes before we come to what we thought of as the wrapping up part. So I don't mean, so please go right ahead.
These two, please.
Yeah.
So
that's really interesting.
Can
you use the short button on the field of what you have just said? I'm asking you correctly. Do you think if someone who knows the infection from the side, they could provide somebody knowing that? What do you mean by that note that causes the conceptualized knowing of itself? Or are you leading to a knowing that may be more acceptable or approachable, or a lay person who knows his or her self through the interactions with the animate and the inanimate world? Because even in literature, it's scientific, completely literal, or there is a clear distinction between knowing the mind and knowing as a process, knowing my stomach and get around principles. If I have to clarify by oversimplifying it and relating it how children look appropriately comfortable and as proper adults with the information, Johnny, not the team, or the world that he like, touches or walks simply on the market and bites in the other one. Because pretty much we have a problem with more about the table than I do, if you get the table on the and knows it as two different styles that what the table is more, for example, under the on the support. And as soon as Mommy said that Johnny got to the table, so alive, Mommy took the wedge by introducing the concept of the table. And Johnny, through that verbalization process, when he gets to university and methodology, already is separated from the object, and my conscious attitude is that I am from a psychiatrist for about 20 years now. So my conscious after the 20 years that we know less about that table and ourselves in the context of that table, the concept of the me and the interaction with the object that I'm interacting with, that generally does before he goes to the ritual. Now, coming back, therefore, if we use psychotherapy, for instance, as the background of, I'm not sure that there is a clear distinction between first, second, and third, first approach. Because let's just be very simple without any big concept. Person walks in with low energy, depression, and so on. By the way, also, if we just use the description of the first person, what is it in this life, it might be very different depending on if that person right now is convicted of a major clinical depression versus the same person but after treatment. And culturally, how that comes up too in China, where expression of some emotion culturally but here's a person who walks in and depressed. starting with the first person, we are actually, our inquiry is about the first person experience. We cannot think, how do you feel? The person starts to count to the therapist how they feel. In that very process, it's already a second person inquiry as well, because the facilitator role is the utmost important role in success. In establishing the therapeutic relationship with the second and then here's the third person, who is let's say the psychotherapist or psychiatrist, who's trying to be in the objective realm. So let's say I'm ready to say, okay, maybe this person needs a serotonin booster, and then I'm going to relate it to what might be going on in the brain, and I already maybe following Varela, who says, okay, here's the first person description, what could be the neurophysiological relevance or correlate of that? So that the psychiatrist is already doing that neurophysiological correlate. But why are we separating these things? Are they really separate? And is that the way to arrive to a consistent internally and externally?
And I think the ones who separate those the most really are the people who come from a third-person perspective. I think from a first-person perspective, the analysis you gave shows very good reasons for wanting to be able to move in a kind of a fluid way among all three. But Thomas Nagel, who's famous for asking the what it's like question, said something a little less famous but still well-known. He talked about how science tries to arrive at the view from nowhere, right? And if you make yourself nowhere, if that's your aim, you really eliminate your own involvement in reality, and that's supposed to be the position that gives you truth, then you have no room at all for the first person or the second person. So I think it's when you make that move, which he considers to be characteristic for third person science, that you run into trouble. I think we could discuss in more detail the specifics of the example you gave, but not right here and now. Yes, I think there's a lot of room for moving fluidly, especially between it's a good example. It's a very interesting example to explore further.
Just kind of very helpful. I think there's a distinction between life and intent search. Or in the intent search, what is the search for, or better, who is the search for? So is research something that I want to communicate to anyone can communicate to knowledge? Or is the research something we take? And then when I report, what I report is important for you, but not like universal value. So I think this is the main thing. Why are you doing this? Who are you doing this?
So let's take one more question before we move into a summing up phase, and we'd also like to tell you a little bit about this What It's Like initiative. And I think, Ivan, you were going to ask a question.
No, just a comment. I think that all this discussion which we did today was in third-person language.
Third-person language.
We were actually trying to make formulate a third-person methodology of meta-theory. Of fast and theories.
Mm-hmm.
Without having fast and theories. So it's somewhat the other way around, I think. And the point is that we are a culture which is so much immersed in fast and science and education and so on, that we have hardship to avoid combinations. And so third-person data. The word data for me is typically third-person concept.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to say third-person data?
Mm-hmm.
And so on and so on. So mm-hmm. This is just a
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here was another question.
I thought that was our last. Okay.
I will make it very short. I think Mark was totally right. Because when you look back to these art, which extends and which pocket them, Descartes, in my opinion, never meant to divide it. To look at two things like a point doesn't mean to divide it.
Mm-hmm.
So, if
you want to tackle the art problem directly. I think, first, the explanatory gap doesn't exist. Because when you say, oh, you have two different things and there's a big gap, okay, that's not the problem, I think. The main problem is constantly to divide and divide and divide. And I think, yes, Marco, because he has asked me, so I have to give it back. I think that's the crucial point. If you divide everything, even Buddhism, that truly Buddhist wouldn't divide, what for? And I think, to make it very short, like some philosophers, you have to look at it as one thing, like Whitehead perhaps, one thing in various marks. Then you can concentrate on the art problem, and I think it won't disappear, but it will get smaller and smaller. And if you look at phenomenology or accounts of Sigmund Freud, first person method, then there is no big difference between first and third person.
I think it's a good point to stop and not exactly sum up, because I don't think it's so as though we've been trying to present some coherent perspective, but just reflect a little bit, and maybe the three of us can. I want to say something. Go for a second. So maybe the three of us can make two. I don't. And it came up out of this last comment, and I think actually it's related to what you said too, Ivan, the question of the kind of knowledge that we're after is terrifically important, I think. And Orban asked before, if we had a theory that encompassed things, and we said, yes, this really is a theory of everything in terms of first person and third person, would we have arrived at or necessarily come that much closer to the kind of first person knowledge that we would that we think is important or in some way is most meaningful? And while theories certainly have their role and they open up new opportunities, for me the answer would be pretty much no. I have a way that I phrase this, so I'm going to put it out there, that the way to learn about consciousness is to be conscious differently. And that has nothing to do with theories or with explanations. So, to me, that's a very important moment or insight into the nature of what first-person knowledge would have to be like. That's what I wanted to say.
I would just connect to this and use the opportunity to do some propaganda for our staff. Yes, exactly. I'm just right now doing the introductory speech that was mentioned, this new study of cognitive science that we are doing at six universities, and I'm the Ljubljana part of it. And I decided to do the little booklet of what kind of cognitive science can be studied in Slovenia. And I was being nasty and added the question, what do you think should be the final result of cognitive science? So, and this was asked to neurologists and philosophers. I didn't get all the answers yet, but the results are, there is the one common opinion, which is to understand consciousness. But what actually means to understand consciousness is totally different. From that, let's say, hard part of science, that would be to have a model, to have a nice, really well-working, prediction-enabling model. But on the other, when you see the phenomenologists, then this is different. And if you have people that do some spiritual practice or that they want to do more psychotherapy, spiritual stuff, self-research, it is to, as Jack said, to be conscious differently. That's probably the best way of phrasing it. So I also think, I wouldn't like to choose one of those, but there is one way of knowledge that we call it as realization, which is not knowledge of the propositional kind, but it's something else. It's something where knowing this and acting actually merges. It's not, oh, I know, and then I'm going to act according to this, but it just, and you do it. There is no gap between those two. So, and this kind of knowledge, perhaps, is what we are seeking for, and then, of course, the way should be a little bit different. So, we did decide to start initiating a sort of community for coping, to enable a place where a sort of community of first person failure might develop. And we call it, as I mentioned before, what it's like. We decided it to be first the internet forum, and it is supposed to be divided at least in two parts. One would be just the debate as we are having right now, more methodological debates, what is first person research, how to do it, this kind of stuff. And the other, we were thinking of just presenting the first person research. There are many things to be told about our perception of it, but we definitely don't have time about it. I printed out one version of our statement, and I'm going to just stick it on this board out there where announcements are. So please just write your email on it if you want me to send it to you by email. And also, you write your email if you wish to participate in any kind, or if you would be interested in sharing something, perhaps you can do some discussion, online discussion or whatever. Just whichever way we could start doing the community of first person research. So that's my proposition. And this is it. I'm gonna let that be here, and then after the session, I'm gonna just stick it somewhere there, and you just put your email there. Is that okay?
And we can. It's not online right now, but I think we will put it online.
Yeah.
If you go to www.creativeinquiry.org. You'll see that one of the fields of inquiry is actually a number, but one of them is consciousness. And so if you go to that, it'll be obvious where you can download the kind of prospectus, if that's too strong a word, the prospectus for this, what it's like. And if you have any other questions about that, I don't think we have a kind of a general inquiry, but you can always just write me. It's just jack@creativeinquiry.org. Even if you just want to be put on the mailing list, something like that. Or want to know more about this as it develops. So, a few comments. I think we want to break right at 7 because that bus is leaving for the wine tasting. I'm quite sure it won't leave right on the dot of 7.
We can go on the wine reception.
That's true.
Chama told me that he'll be speaking about the wine selection, about meaning of love. Immediately after that, we can go on and because, you know, this is a big topic, but I hope you're not too
disappointed. Okay. Thank you very much, everybody. It's been a pleasure.